Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I'm Matt.
And today we're talking about why your house is an awful investment.
Yeah, but first, Joel, I feel like we've been opening a lot of accounts lately, and you're just talking about one that you are about to open or that you already have?
Already have. Yeah, definitely.
Fill me in.
Account overload at this point in time.
Well, you and me both, because, you know, like I mentioned my my photography business account, which, by the way, it's going pretty sweet.
Oh, the Bank of Internet?
Yeah.
Nice. Which still sounds fake, but it's real.
Sounds totally fake. And, you know, I think they thought it sounded fake, too, and so they changed it. They're kind of going with B of I.
Sounds a little more professional.
And actually, and they added federal to it. So it's B of I federal .com is the actual URL.
Now anyway, that sounds like a classy institution.
Yeah, federal? That's legit. So they just sent me an ATM card for that account. And it's the first piece of mail I've gotten from them. You know, normally you open an account and you just like are flooded with all this material and promotional stuff. And not them, dude. I've gotten zero. I've gotten nothing from them until today. I got my my unmarked envelope, and I could tell there's a card in there. I was like, what is this?
That's good, man. How much are banks wasting on all the mail they
do? It is great.
It's overwhelming.
Yeah.
Right now, man, I wanted to let everyone know that the initial sign-up bonus offers for changing banks are awesome. They're out there in full force. And so I just signed up for a new savings account with Discover, Discover's online bank. And they run a great business. I really like what they're up to. And I had a $200 bonus waiting for me if I put $25,000 in a savings account with them and keep it there for a month. So that's pretty easy barriers to jump through and just make $200 pretty quickly. And so there are a lot of offers like that right now going on, in particular this summer. So look around. I know some are up to $750. Those are usually only applicable if you've got like $100,000 sitting there and are willing to move it over.
Like a big old deposit.
Yeah.
Like a fatty, just throwing it over there.
But even today, I got something in the mail from Chase. So Chase has like $300 if I open up a checking account and $200 if I open up a savings account for a potential total of $500. And so, you know, I think sometimes it is a pain, and I'm not saying that everyone should jump through all these hoops and open up 10, you know, bank accounts. The Discover one was pretty chill for me, and so I decided to take advantage of it, and especially, you know, only needing to be there for a month. And also just kind of, you know, I think they have some good products.
Well, yeah, so that's the thing. Are you just basically parking in there for a month to get the bonus and then you can pull it out and you're totally fine?
Yep, exactly. And, you know, who knows? I'll see, you know, how the account goes and maybe I'll, you know, keep some of my money there depending on, you know, their other benefits. But I think it's definitely worth pointing out that just like people use credit card bonuses, credit card signups to kind of make some extra money on the side or to get bonus travel perks, I think opening up a bank account or two here and there when you're offered a pretty sweet signup bonus, that's, you know, worth considering taking advantage of.
Oh, but wait, are you still planning to keep the rest of your money though with CIT?
Yeah, so most of my money will, you know, likely stay with CIT just because their interest rate is higher than anybody else's. And so, right now the big chunk of my cash is with Discover. You know, I might keep the bank account around for a while, depending, but yeah, I might not just close it outright. But the CIT interest rate is pretty good. I don't want to pass that up. So yeah. I'll definitely keep most of my cash in that account for the time being.
Yeah, man. Well, speaking of sign-up bonuses and credit cards, you know, that's my favorite. That's my go-to. And specifically, I love that, and you mentioned Chase as well, but the Chase Inc. Business Preferred Card. I don't think you can beat it, because that sign-up is $850, man. And that's after 3 months, you have to spend $5,000, which for some folks that kind of might be, you know, that's kind of a tall order. But I'm able to put all my business expenses on there and stuff with the rentals. It's not that difficult to kind of rack up, especially I feel like this time of year, into the summer, there's just a lot of stuff breaking.
Yeah.
I can't put the HVAC on there like I told you about recently. But
although, interesting tip for folks, there is a new company, a new website called Plastiq, PlastiQ.com.
Q, okay.
And they supposedly...
Plastiq?
Yes. And I guess. They essentially let you put anything on a credit card. So if you need to meet a spending threshold in order to get that sweet sign-up bonus,
yeah,
you know, Plastiq or Plastiq, however they pronounce it, is worth considering, because they will let you pay with a credit card for anything, including, you know, mortgage payments. I read an article. Someone bought a Tesla through Plastiq on their credit card. Yes. And so they charge a 2.5% fee, which normally would be, you know, more than your rewards would cover. Like even the best reward cards, usually that you get 2%, right? So you would be paying a 0.5% spread, but that's not necessarily the case for
the signup bonus,
big signup bonuses exactly. And stuff like that. And so, that's kind of cool if you are into kind of the credit card hacking and sign-up bonuses and stuff like that, you know, and you're bummed that you can't pay a car payment or a mortgage payment with your credit card because you use them wisely. Remember, you use your credit cards wisely, hopefully.
Yeah, honestly, that's what I was about to say. I was going to say like this, you know, fair warning, this is like the credit card hacking and the sign-up bonuses, this is a little more, I hate even saying this because it sounds a little shady and just, it's just a little more advanced. And if you're kind of struggling with credit card debt and consumer spending, don't sign up for the new credit card just to get the bonus, because it doesn't matter if you're getting great cash back or if you're getting like that really sweet bonus. If you're paying 20% on your payments because you're not paying your statements in full, then it is 100% not worth it.
Yes. But if you are one of those people that pays your credit cards off in full, no matter what.
Yeah. If you're a total nerd
and you're into the signup bonuses, PLASTIQ.com is worth checking out. You create an account, you enter the recipient, you tell them who you want to pay, and then Plastique accepts any of your credit cards and charges you 2.5%. I guess, or less, it says, potentially per transaction. Apparently, sometimes they run bonuses and stuff like
interesting.
That. So you enter in the recipient.
I guess they just take it, and then they just mail, you know, they cut a check and then they just send an official certified check to whoever you want it sent to.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool, man.
Interesting.
I like that business model.
It's smart. It's creative.
Yeah, for the Uber nerds in the financial community, like, man, this is like music to your ears, right? Just so you can meet some of those hefty sign-on bonuses.
Yeah, because I know a lot of folks also do that with the airline miles. I honestly know nothing about airline miles, like the rewards, and there's like a bunch of other fancy stuff you can do with rewards. But we just, man, this stage of life that we're in, we're not doing a lot of flying, you know?
Right.
We're definitely not doing a lot of flying with our girls. Like my brother-in-law, they just flew up to Wisconsin and it was the first time they've done it, but their daughter's only one. And I'm like, man, our oldest is almost 5 and she's never been on a plane still, you know? We're just trying to avoid that.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. Once you get into having a family of, you know, 4 or 5 and you're paying for that many plane tickets, it just gets really expensive.
Yeah, it's super expensive, man. We're just going to load up in the van.
Yeah.
That's right. The minivan. We're going to drive up there.
Everyone thinks you're cool in that thing, bro.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. But when it comes to travel reward credit cards, you know, I haven't done the digging either. I know I know where the great resources are and I will turn to them when I'm ready. But there definitely are a lot of great resources out there for you if you are into and in that period of life where you want to do some travel hacking. And you know what? Soon on the podcast, we need to get an expert on so we can learn and learn along with our audience, you know, how to kind of take advantage of some of those, you know, travel credit card offers.
Yeah, let's do that soon.
All right, on to the beer. I'm going to let you pronounce this one.
Yeah, so this is from Brewery Taru. And this specific beer is called The Ruse. And this is from 2015. So this is an aged beer, which is awesome. Man, this specific beer, this is a big old bomber, right? So that's 750 milliliters. And dude, you're not going to guess how much I got this beer for. I'm just going to tell you, I got it for $3.80.
What? You're shopping that discount shelf, man.
Exactly. And you know what? I've been to this place before. This is the that massive beer store in Augusta that I visit when I go to visit my parents. And Kate and I swung in there when the girls were down for a nap. I spotted this bad boy on the shelf and picked up a couple. You can't turn down. I mean, Brewery Taru, they make awesome beers. And then on top of that, you know, you can't get a 750 for 380. That's
bonkers.
Yeah, it's just too good to pass up. Plus, I pulled the beer up on Untappd and searched it real quick, and it crushes. Yep. So,
and by the way, if you're not on Untappd, that's the Primo app. That's what I always go to if I'm in the store and I'm like, is this beer any good? Before I buy it, I want to know.
And that's Untappd.
And you can. We've had a bunch of our listeners follow us on Untappd, and it's kind of fun to see what they're drinking and for them to see what we're drinking. So you can follow Matt at Not Poor Matt on Untappd, and you can follow me at Not Poor Joel on the app.
That is us.
And okay, I want to say something really quick about the brewery. It used to just be the brewery, Brewery, and they at some point a few years back, they divided into two different distinct breweries, you know, one that specializes in regular beers and one that specializes in barrel aging. And Brewery Taru is that other brewery. And the cool thing about the brewery is when they launched, they only package their beers in these large format 750 milliliter bottles, like the size of a bottle of wine. But nobody else was doing that. They were the only one. And everyone thought they were going to fail because people didn't buy beer in big bottles like that. They liked a six pack of beer, right? That was just kind of the standard for how you bought beer, was in a six pack. But the brewery now at this point has essentially broken off, and there are two different breweries, and they sell so much beer, and they make some of the best beer out there. I'm really pumped to have this one because I love everything they make.
I feel like the biggest characteristic of a lot of their beers that they make that I enjoy are aggressive.
No doubt.
You know, like there's just no subtle flavors when it comes to their beers. It's very aggressive. These bigger bottles, you have to split. You have to share with a friend because you just get palate fatigue. I honestly can't finish one of these by myself. And it's just more fun, obviously, to drink with a buddy.
Lightweight.
Oh, please, man. I'd like to see you throw one of these down now.
Don't dare me. Give me your glass right now.
Let's do it. And so on the bottle here, it says this is a sour blonde ale aged in oak barrels. It's earthy, sharp, and funky.
Cheers, buddy.
Cheers.
This is like exactly what I love and exactly what my wife hates. If you go back and listen to that episode, this is the beer that she's talking about that she does not like. Oh, but that has to be the best $3 bottle of beer ever. That's delicious.
I definitely should have picked up more of these, man. Holy crap.
Next time this happens, like this sort of fortuitive event where you find $3 amazing bottles of beer, please text me. I will essentially force you to buy me large amounts. It's like super tart. It's definitely earthy, like it says. And it's got this huge oak presence at the same time.
Oh, that is so good.
That's lovely.
These beers don't really go bad. You know, we talked about how Goose's can last a really long time. And this one in particular, this is from 2015. So this is 3 years old.
Yeah. And they usually have a shelf life of like 20 years.
Yeah.
For real.
Yeah, that's right. This one doesn't specifically say that. But I got to think it was cellared properly at the right temperature, because to me, this tastes fantastic. And I just got to think they weren't moving enough of these bottles and they just needed to make room on the shelf.
Yeah, completely.
Man, their losses is our gain.
Thanks, Brewery Taru. We're loving this delicious $3 beer. All right, Matt, on to the super contentious topic that we have picked for this show. Your house is an awful investment.
That's right, man. A big reason we're talking about this is because a lot of people accept that your primary residence is thought of as a great investment, right? And that is often accepted as sort of like a gospel truth. Without question, it's a great investment. And we wanted to talk about that because we don't believe that that's true.
Yeah, and more than anything, when you're deciding to buy a primary house, it requires a lot of critical thinking, a lot of analysis to make sure that you're buying something that works for you financially and isn't actually just going to be a drain, like buying or leasing a new car would be, right? And so this American dream, right, this huge part of our culture has been home ownership. That's always been lifted up as a super high ideal in our country. And most folks just kind of buy into that blindly, that that's just the next step, right, on the ladder of American success is to own their own home. And while I think people will hear that you and I both think that there are good reasons for owning home, there are also a lot of reasons that a primary house is a terrible investment. And so we want you to think about all these factors. It gives you a lot of things to think about as you're approaching a potential major purchase like this. You know, before you sink a huge down payment or, you know, saddle yourself, you know, for a home for 30 years, you know, before you jump into a major decision like that, to actually run through some of these, you know, cons and, you know, run the numbers and think about whether, you know, a primary home purchase actually makes sense for you as an investment.
Yeah, that's right, man. So a home could be a great purchase for you from a personal standpoint, from a lifestyle standpoint, from just sort of the stage of life that you're in. This, you know, moving every year or every couple of years may not be something that you want to do. It can be a great thing for you and for your lifestyle, but from a financial investment standpoint, it's not a great investment. It's still an investment. Chances are, over the long term, your home values will rise. There might be dips from year to year, but over time, you will see that value increase. You're just not going to see it increase as much as you're going to see the stock market increase year after year.
Yeah, and you'll hear, you know, us be a little bit bullish on homes in general. I think there are a lot of good reasons to own a home. And, you know, Matt and I really enjoy owning homes. You know, actually, both of us own 4 homes, 1 personal residence each, and then 3 rental homes. And, you know, we actually did an episode on renting versus buying a home. That was episode number 15. And we think that's, you know, kind of worth listening to maybe alongside of this, you know, as you consider whether or not you should be renting or buying. But ultimately, what we want to do is dispel the myth that buying a home is always a good investment. And in particular, it's the word investment that I have a problem with.
Yes. Yep.
You know, I think, you know, a good buy, you know, that's different. Sometimes, you know, a $100 55-inch television is a good buy, but it's not a good investment. And so people use that word investment so quickly and easily in our culture. Hey, I just bought a boat. This is an awesome investment, right? And it's just not. And so that word just needs to be used carefully. So just be aware up front that we're not trying to say that, you know, buying a home is a terrible idea. Buying a home for you to live in, don't do it. You should be a renter all your life. But it's that word investment, and that's what we're going to focus on in this episode.
Yeah, 100%, man. Yeah, man, we recently talked about this because we were sort of inspired by an article that was written like years and years ago by Jim Collins. This was a great article essentially talking about this. He was kind of covering why owning a home isn't a great investment. And I know I've had some conversations with friends who, especially after the housing crisis in 07 and 08, they talked about how, oh, we're never going to purchase a home because they were so sort of scared by the turn that the housing market took. And that being said, the specific friend I'm thinking about owns a home. And, you know, at this point, I think they kind of were able to ease out of that period of life. But it's worth discussing. It's worth talking about how it's just not automatic that purchasing a home, a primary residence, is a great investment.
Well, that's a great point, I think, Matt, because yeah, a lot of people felt that way after the housing downturn. Like, oh man, all my confidence in housing is shot and there's no way I'm going to buy a house again. And the same thing happened with the stock market, right? There were a lot of people that said, I'm never buying stocks again. I don't trust the market. I don't trust, you know, my money there for the future. And ultimately what you're saying, I think to a certain extent with both of those things, is I don't trust the American economy, because people buy homes when they're making money. People make money when businesses make money. When businesses make money, the stock market does well.
And that's right.
That's an oversimplification, but... But I think, you know, if your confidence is shot in either one of those things, the people that at that time, you know, certainly fear does a lot to a person's psyche. But hopefully in this podcast episode, we're trying to go through, you know, some of the historical numbers, some of the historical data. And, you know, the last 10 years from where the stock market was and from where the housing market was, you'd be a fool not to be bullish and not to say, you know, if things were going to continue along at the same rate for the next 10 years, well, go all in. You know, but that's a terrible idea to think that the past would predict the future, you know, for the last 10 years over the next 10 years, just in the same way that to think that housing and stock market crash in 2007, 2008 is indicative, you know, of the way the next 10 years would be after that. And so we want to go kind of historical. Here are the things you actually need to consider when buying a primary home. And we think we'll have some sound advice for you when you're actually considering it, so that you don't buy something that is going to actually become more of like a weight around your neck than this like joyous place for you to live.
That's right, Joel. And we're going to tell you exactly why your home is an awful investment right after this break. Okay, man, let's go ahead and get into the reasons why your home, and specifically we are talking about your primary residence, why it is an awful financial investment. The number one reason is because of poor returns. So over the course of several years, over the long term, a house will appreciate. It just does not appreciate as much as the stock market will. Since the 60s, the U.S. Census Bureau and the National Association of Realtors on average showed an increase of about 4% annually in home values. And over that same period, the stock market showed returns over 10%, man. So you're looking at 4% versus 10%. And if you're looking at it purely from the angle of what is a better investment, what are you going to take? 10% or 4%?
10% every day.
Exactly, exactly. And so the number one reason is you're not going to get the same kind of returns that you're going to get out of increasing home values that you're going to get out of the stock market.
Yeah, Matt, another reason that your home is likely a terrible investment is that homes are not productive in actually generating you money. So money invested in the stock market earns interest and pays you dividends along the way too. And, you know, your home is actually just sitting there kind of siphoning cash, you know, saying, hey, help me, I need a new roof or whatever it is. And so it's actually, you know, costing you not only, you know, the mortgage and taxes. So your house just really doesn't actively produce you any money.
Another point we wanted to bring up is just how expensive a home is as an investment. There are a lot of different ways that it's expensive. The first one I want to cover here is that it just costs a lot of money to get a home. You have to sort of go all in. It just takes a lot of money to get that first home. You know, you're looking at putting 20% down, and that it just takes a lot of money to kind of even get your foot in the game. So the median price of a home today in America is right around $250,000. And so 20% down on $250,000, that's $50,000. So imagine trying to buy a stock where just to get that one stock, like one share of stock, is $50,000. I wouldn't do it. It's just so expensive just to get that one singular undiversified stock.
And that's a big point, Matt, because you said not diversified, right? And so
yes,
you're buying this one house built of, you know, brick and, or wood and cement and drywall.
Maybe plastic. I don't know.
Maybe plastic.
Maybe you get that vinyl siding.
On this one particular plot of land in this, you know, one particular state, city, town, street, and yeah, your diversification in that is not very good at all. It's actually, in fact, the opposite of good. And so when it comes to investing, you actually want a lot of diversification, exposure to, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different companies throughout the country and that actually do business throughout the world. And a primary home is actually the exact opposite of being well diversified.
Yeah, from a financial investment, it's very, very risky. Another huge expense, if you're going to consider your home as an investment, is that it costs a ton of money to maintain. Most experts, and I've seen this from my personal life as well, is that it costs about 1% of the price of the home, so the purchase price, it costs about 1% of that to maintain annually. And so take the example I just said, right? The $250,000 median home in America. You're looking at $2,500 a year that you're just putting towards maintaining that home. On the flip side of that, we have stock investments that are spread out all across the market, very well diversified, that have an expense ratio. And I'm sort of equating the two, right? You've got like expenses that it takes to maintain your home. And then on stocks, you've got expense ratios because that's just the sort of ongoing cost that you have with it. And the two funds that we're the biggest fans of, you're looking at an expense ratio of 0.04%. There's a huge difference between 1% and 0.04%.
We're talking about 20 times, or more than 20 times, right?
I don't even know. It's a ton. So going back to that $250,000 home, if we had the same expense ratio that you would have with our favorite funds, which is 0.04%, instead of paying $2,500 a year in maintaining your home, it would only cost you $100.
Yeah, that's a huge difference.
Dude, isn't that insane when you look at it that way?
Yeah, that's completely crazy and definitely puts a win in the column of investing in stocks as opposed to considering your primary home an investment. Yeah, Matt, and the next huge expense that people often fail to consider or at least just don't factor in when they're considering their primary home as an investment is the costs incurred when buying and selling that home. And so the average realtor fees in the United States, they're higher than a lot of other places in the world, are 3% per realtor. So just to buy and sell that home, and usually, you know, the seller incurs most of these costs, but as a buyer, you should be thinking about, you know, the future, the exit strategy, right? And so you need to be thinking about what it's actually going to cost for you to get out of that home at some point. And so when you're buying a stock or an ETF, you're assuming, hopefully, rightly, you're doing business with, you know, Vanguard or M1 Finance, like the app we talked about last episode. You're paying, you know, zero or incredibly minuscule fees to unload that stock or ETF. But when it comes to selling your home, not only are you paying that 1% every year to maintain it, but you're paying huge costs by percentage just to get out of that house. And that's not even factoring in, you know, lender closing costs, getting an inspection performed on the property, you know, before you buy it, and then other random things.
And there's always like 10 or 12 additional line items you see like on that statement, you know?
Yeah. So it's really expensive to buy and sell homes. There's all those other, you know, factors that come into play. But when you're investing in the stock market, it's simple, it's clean, and it's low cost.
I hope by the end of this doesn't just convince me to sell all of our properties and just be done with it, man.
Well, I was just thinking that this is a great time just to reassure people. We're going to get to some reasons why I think that homes can be a really good move. I think if you're listening right now, you're thinking, yeah, but a home isn't just an investment, right? It is a place where I live. It means something to me, and it's, you know, four walls around me and a bedroom and a bathroom and a kitchen, and it's got all these things that I need. Like, I have to spend money on a place to live no matter what.
Yeah, somehow you're going to spend money to live somewhere no matter what.
Right, and so that is the thing. That's something that we do need to clear up and make sure people know, and we'll get to a little bit later on in the podcast too, that obviously the only consideration when buying a home is not the investment payoff of that home, right? There are a lot of other considerations to make. So we will get to those. But right now, we're just kind of playing this mind game and helping you think about your home when it comes to thinking about, you know, how you buy a home. And ultimately, that huge cultural thought that a primary residence is a great investment and taking that as gospel truth. We're kind of trying to debunk, you know, some of those myths. But then, you know, we'll also hit the flip side, you know, here in just a few minutes too.
So we just touched on this, how there is a lack of diversification when you have a single home. And what we didn't discuss then, though, is that there is so much that can ride on specific businesses or local governments that you just don't have control over. And so what if a local factory closes that is a huge employer of a lot of the people in your area? Or say the local government just decides to increase the taxes like crazy. These are things you don't have control over that have a huge impact on the value of your home. And so again, this is another example of sort of all your eggs being in one single basket.
Yeah, there are all these external factors that you can't control, you know, and you might think that you're buying in this awesome place, but then, you know, a public transportation system either fails or, you know what, maybe you don't have public transit and it comes to the community where you are and that's not good for your community. I don't know. There are all sorts of external factors that can affect that quote unquote investment that you've made in this home and that you have absolutely no control over. And that's tough. Like, obviously, you don't have control over the stock market as a whole and where that goes, but at least you know that it's well diversified. And so if one company completely screws things up, like Enron, right, that affects your portfolio minimally. But if your home takes a nosedive and you're all in on that, that's a gigantic hit to your portfolio.
And then also related to location as well, when it comes time to sell, like you were mentioning that exit strategy, you're limited to the buyers that want to buy in that specific region. So for example, think about selling a share of a fund that you have. Anyone in the entire world could buy that stock or that fund at the market rate. But when you're listing your home, you're limited to whoever is only interested in your specific area. It just really limits the pool of the potential people who could buy that quote unquote investment from you.
Whether you're in Synecdoche, New York, or Perry, Georgia.
Never heard of that first one.
Oh, really? There's a movie about it.
Oh, is there really?
Yeah.
I know Poughkeepsie.
Oh, Poughkeepsie. So that's going. Wherever you are out of those cities, there's just a finite amount of buyers. And Sacramento is going to have more than Perry, Georgia. But still, no matter where you're at, you are talking about a smaller segment of buyers. And also, depending on the price range that you're in, right? If you're in a more expensive home, you're appealing to an even smaller segment of buyers. So there are all those things to consider about your home as a primary investment that if you do decide to list your home, you might be appealing to a really small segment of people. And that's just really hard compared to selling stock, like Matt said.
That's right, man. So next, we are going to get to some tips and some ways that you can make your primary home a better investment. But first, let's take a break.
All right, Matt, we back. So we've gone over a bunch of reasons why your home is an awful investment, but now let's kind of hit the flip side. So purchasing and owning a home, it can actually be a great lifestyle choice for you, and perhaps you can turn it into a good financial move as well. Most people don't think like that when it comes to their primary home, but we want you to think like that. And so we're going to kind of give you some tips to turn your primary home into a decent financial investment, even though we just kind of ran through a bunch of reasons why it's not.
Hey man, we're going to cover some tips on ways to make your home a better investment. But first, we just need to acknowledge the fact that typically we don't buy a primary residence to be an investment, right? Like you get a home to live in because it's in a community that you want to be a part of, because you want some permanence. There's a lot of benefits that we talked about in the renting versus owning episode where we talk about the benefits of owning your own place. But yeah, fact is you've got to pay to live somewhere. There just can be a big difference between what is sort of the bare minimum amount that you could pay to live somewhere, to pay rent, versus what maybe most people would purchase and consider, quote unquote, an investment.
Yeah, I think, Matt, you know, whether I'm renting or buying, ultimately every month, you know, money is going to come out of my bank account to either a landlord or to a bank. So I'm going to pay to live somewhere no matter what, right? I need, you know, four walls and a bathroom and a kitchen, all those things around me, or that's just at least, I guess, what I've come to expect. And so that's what I'm going to have.
Yeah, you need a bathroom. That's good.
It helps. It helps. And so I think that definitely throws, you know, this huge giant wrench into a debate about whether a primary home is a good investment or not, because you're going to be paying every month for a place to live, whether it's a primary residence that you own or it's a home that you rent from a landlord. And so we kind of have to take that into the equation and include that in the way we think through things. But at least I hope that some of the things that we discussed, you know, above make you think twice about using the word investment for your primary home and make you instead kind of run the numbers and think through, you know, all the costs involved and the fees associated with buying a home so that you don't just aimlessly, blindly walk into buying a primary home thinking that it's just a great investment that's going to appreciate over time. We want to kind of like throw out some of those shock value things that make you think twice, you know, about the actual cost of a home and what you're paying, not to mention, you know, the interest that you're going to be paying. Usually, even in this low interest rate environment, double the price that you're borrowing, you know, over 30 years. If you borrow $200,000 for a home, you're likely going to pay more than $400,000 for that actual home over 30 years. And so, you know, those costs that come along with buying a primary home, they certainly need to be factored in. But it's definitely important to recognize that a primary home is not purchased by most people for the sole reason of being an investment.
So that being said, if you do want to purchase a home, here are some tips, some ways that you can help your primary residence, your home. You're still not going to be clearing money every month. You're still not going to come out ahead like you would with an investment property or a rental property. But again, these are some ways that you can minimize the amount that you're spending on your primary home and to offset some of those costs.
Yeah, so the first thing that you can do when you're looking for a primary residence to make sure that it's a good buy and it's not going to be as bad of an investment as it could be and that it actually will work out in your favor over time is to buy a home that's a deal. And so the more you know your market, the more you know specific neighborhoods, like we've talked about in some of our real estate investing podcasts, it's really important to kind of know streets and know neighborhoods. And that way, when a deal pops up, you're ready to pounce. And the same thing is true for buying a primary home. You want to make sure that you're getting as good a deal as possible. And so if you see a home pop on the market that is, you know, 10 or 15% undervalued and you're ready to jump on a moment's notice and get that deal, well, ultimately you've got some equity built in already just by buying at a reduced rate. And another thing you can do to kind of enhance that as well is to buy a home that needs some love. Put some sweat equity into that beast. And that's a great way to make a, you know, poor investment, actually a decent investment over time because you bought something that nobody else really wanted. You put the work in and you're reaping the rewards, you know, based on the hard work that you have contributed to the home.
That's right, man. There's nothing wrong with trading some of that time for money. And of course, we want to keep some of the basics in mind as well, which are you want to make sure you are always putting down 20%. You want to be sure to avoid that PMI. That is an additional expense that you do not need on an quote-unquote investment that is already going to be underperforming. And because of how expensive it is to buy and sell a property, you want to make sure that you're staying in that home for at least 5 years to break even of those expenses. Ideally, even longer, right? Ideally, if you could stay in there from 7 to even 10 years, that's, you know, for a lot of people, that might be a stretch to think, oh man, where am I going to be 10 years from now? Will I even want to be in the same city? That might be tough. But that's how you need to think about it when you're going into buying a primary residence, when you're looking at buying a home. You want to also make sure that you're giving the house time to appreciate. It's not just about sort of recouping those costs and spreading those over more years, but you're looking and hoping that your house is going to continue to rise in value and that you're going to be able to, you know, reap some of those rewards and get some of that appreciation, have that translate into the check at the closing table.
Yeah, and that 20% number is really important, obviously, to avoid private mortgage insurance, which could cost you a couple hundred dollars a month, right, added to your mortgage payments. But on top of that, let's say you do get a loan where you put 3% down, and let's say it's a $100,000 home, you put 3% down, and the market declines, and your $100,000 home is suddenly worth $86,000, right? You're only $3,000 of your own hard-earned money into that deal. If you need to sell it for some reason, if you have a hardship reason that you need to sell your house, you need to move because you found another job or something happened and you need to be closer to family. Well, whatever that is, you're negative in the hole and you might not have the cash to come to the closing table to cover not just that deficit in the value of your home, but also those closing costs, those other costs that we talked about up front.
So another 6% on top of that.
Right.
That loss.
So yeah. It's hugely important that you come to the table with 20% down to avoid PMI and to avoid a situation like that in the event of a market decline.
Yeah, Joel, that's right. Also, be sure to be careful when renovating and updating because you may not get that money out when it comes time to sell. You need to know and own that those upgrades that you're making, in reality, you are purchasing lifestyle upgrades, and be sure to try to avoid to look at those expenses as investments.
Yeah, if you look around online, you can find a lot of articles about how much return is a kitchen renovation or a bathroom renovation actually going to get you. And usually the returns are in the negative, right? So if you put $60,000 into a kitchen renovation, you might see $35,000 or $40,000 in increased value. And so something else that comes along with that American myth of home ownership always being a great investment is thinking that you can continue to sink money into that investment and that you'll always reap the rewards on the other side when you eventually sell the home. or in, you know, in the appreciation rate of that home. And that's just rarely the case. Usually the improvements that you make, right, they deteriorate over time. And most of the time, the changes that people make saying that they're for quote unquote investment reasons are just because, yeah, I didn't really like the bathroom and I wanted a new one. And that's okay. As long as you know going into it, you're putting in your money for a bathroom that you enjoy more, as opposed to calling it an investment and then moving forward on it. Because the truth is, you're not going to get a straight up dollar for dollar even return on the money you put in for a bathroom renovation or a kitchen renovation. You're actually going to lose money. So I hope you like it.
Man, that's so true. You know what it makes me think of is one of the first things that a lot of people say when they get a new place and they like show you the new digs and they're like, oh yeah, check this out. But we're gonna rip this out and we're gonna do this. Oh, we're gonna replace the tile over here. We're gonna do this as well. And that's unfortunate, right? It's wasteful. But what I'm pointing out is that some of the changes that you might make thinking that somebody else down the road, someone that buys your house is gonna appreciate, they may not appreciate it. You know, there's a good chance that what you're doing, like Joel said, what you're doing, it's for you. And again, that's okay, but just own that it's for you. Unless you're adding an additional bathroom or additional square footage or something like that, where it's more of a hard sort of tangible addition to the home. A lot of times you'll see more of a return on that kind of improvement on the home. But in particular, finishes don't go very far.
Yeah, and so a tip for folks that are buying a home, right? Consider buying something that is more in disrepair. And so when you're making those improvements, you actually are getting more of a return on that investment. And if you're able to do some of that work yourself, you're going to see even more of a return. And so if you are able to do, you know, a bathroom renovation, you know, on the cheap, but make it look good from a bathroom that was pretty much non-functional, then you're definitely going to see a return. So that comes down to being a smart buyer when you're looking at real estate, when you're looking to buy a home, as opposed to, you know, buying something that looks perfectly good, but you just want to change for your own aesthetic.
Another tip is do not buy the biggest house on the block or the biggest house in the neighborhood. When you're talking about your home appreciating, you're not going to see nearly the appreciation on a larger home or a home that's sort of at the top of the sort of immediate market as you are going to see on a home sort of right there in the middle, where you are going to see a lot more room for growth. Keep that in mind.
Yeah, but ultimately the biggest way to purchase a home and actually turn it into a decent investment where it wasn't otherwise is if you can try your hand at house hacking. And house hacking is essentially become the popular phrase for finding ways to make a little bit of money on your home. And that means either renting out a spare bedroom in a single family home, or better yet, buying a multifamily home, you know, living in one of the units and then renting out the others. So if you were to buy a triplex, right, you live in one portion of the house, you rent out the other two, and everybody else covers your mortgage. So doing something like that actually flips the tables and makes a home a much better investment, right, than it otherwise would have been. And if you're just buying a single family home and you have your family in it and you're not ready to, you know, start renting out rooms to strangers, well, maybe consider buying a place with an in-law suite or putting an Airstream in the back of your yard like I'm considering. And we talked about in episode number 3, something like that can kind of flip the tables a little bit too, where you can actually make a little bit of money from your house anytime, any way that you can do something like that. That's going to make your house a little less of a financial drain and maybe add a little cash into your life.
Yeah, man, that's right. That's one of the sort of downsides we mentioned earlier on, that your primary residence, it's just unproductive. You've got a lot of equity just sitting there idle. And unless you do a home equity loan or a cash out refi, that sort of thing, and then only take that money to invest, you aren't really able to tap into that money. And so house hacking, that's a great way, like you said, to put that money to work. And even potentially completely eliminating your monthly housing costs. You know, I've heard stories where somebody bought a house and they are single and they just didn't necessarily want to live alone, and they got 2 or 3 roommates to live with them. Their combined rents completely covered the mortgage and then some. That is 100% an example of someone taking their primary residence and house hacking it to where they're not only reducing the amount that they're spending every month on their housing, they're actually creating income from that house. And that's just an incredible way to build wealth. For most folks, housing, it's by far the number one expense that people have every month, their mortgage payment. After that, typically it's transportation costs. If you're able to take something that is normally an expense every month and instead take that from, like, say, a negative $1,200 or negative $1,800, just whatever your rent or whatever your mortgage payment is, to say a positive, to like maybe you're making $300, or, you know, if you're making bank and you're making like $5,000 a month, you have officially crossed into great investment territory. You know, like your home is no longer an awful investment. It is a fantastic cash flowing investment.
Yeah, because like we said, everybody pays for a place to live. And if you can figure out a way to kind of minimize those costs of your living expenses every month, man, that's killer. And brainstorming that can completely change your financial picture.
Yeah, man. And this is something that you guys actually do. You want to share some about the apartment in the back of your house?
Yeah. So our house has a tiny kitchen in the back and bathroom. And there's just a door that divides essentially the front part of the house from the back part of the house. And my wife and I and our two girls, we live in the front 1,300 square feet. And we rent out that back 700 square feet. And it covers, you know, more than half the mortgage. And it works out really just to eliminate a huge chunk of our housing costs every month. And the first house that I bought too was a single family home. And I rented out a room in there until my wife and I got married, just to kind of cut my housing costs for a time and save a little bit more money. So anytime you can kind of think about your house, think about a way that you can Airbnb a room, or maybe turn a small part of your home, create a kitchenette, and have someone that goes to your church or lives in your neighborhood that's looking for a new place to live, you know, have them live there and pay you rent. Anything that you can do to kind of maximize that house and take it from being like this liability, this drain on your finances every month, into kind of positive territory. That's a huge win.
Yeah, that's huge, man.
And it makes just like this immense ultimate impact on your finances.
Yeah, certainly. And that's, I mean, really, that's what we're trying to do. It's been a minute since we've talked about this on the podcast, but we're looking to sort of create an Airbnb apartment. Originally, we talked about sort of digging out some of the space that I've got, this unfinished space I have under our house. I have since decided that that probably isn't going to work out.
AKA wimped out.
Yeah, wimped out slash just got way too freaking busy. But we're also going to be adding on to our current living space as well. And so we're finding a way to potentially offset the expenses from our mortgage, while also we are adding on to the usability and the functionality that we have in our current home. And we're owning that as well. We know that, okay, with this, we're going to see a return on our investment, certainly. But we're also doing this knowing that we're most definitely going to be getting some utility out of the additional space. And we're not talking about the finished space that we're planning to rent out. We're talking about the space above that, right? So that's where we are. And that's just part of it. I feel like we're being honest with ourselves. We know that this isn't 100% for investment purposes and to have an ROI on the project. But it's also partly to increase the utility of our own home.
Yeah. And I think, like, if you're single and you're buying a home, these are just great things to think about. If you're married and you're buying a home, these are great things to talk about with your partner. What do we want? You know, what do we want out of this home? Do we want something that absolutely minimizes our negative financial impact so that we can save and invest as much money as possible and, you know, retire in 10 years? Or do we want to live in a nicer house, in a nicer community, because we've got kids? And it's really important that we live in this neighborhood and raise them, you know, right here. You know, there are all sorts of questions that you need to answer when you're thinking about where you want to live. You know, and for a little more on that, like we said, go back to episode number 15, renting versus buying a home. And I think there are some things in there you can take away. But yeah, a lot of this does come down to lifestyle. And so it doesn't have to be the best investment ever. You know, we think it's really important to make wise investments and to put a decent chunk of what you make every month towards investing. But a home doesn't have to be that for you, right? And it's smart to think about all these things as you go in, to be conscious of the fees and the transaction costs involved in housing. But when it comes down to it, you know, we all have things that aren't investments. We buy things that bring us an amount of happiness or utility and don't provide us cash returns, right? On
those purchases. Yeah, you're not expecting your pants to go up in value necessarily, but maybe, I don't know.
Right, or my New Balances, right, yeah, to provide a return on investment. But those are things that we need and are utilitarian to a certain extent. And a home can be that for you too. You just kind of want to go in eyes wide open, know the costs that are involved, and maybe think a little bit more about getting something more reasonable that impacts your finances less and could potentially actually be a little productive in its addition to your financial state.
And now that we've mentioned like the rent versus buy episode a few times now, it might be helpful for you if you're trying to figure out, okay, how much is it actually going to cost me to purchase a home, not just purchase a home, but maintain the home versus how much I can find a place to rent. For that, I would suggest a rent versus buy calculator in Zillow. They've got a great one online and we'll have a link to that in our show notes. But essentially you do a little bit of research and you see what the market rates are for a home in the area that you're looking at purchasing, as well as the rental rates. And then they prompt you to fill in some of the additional information like insurance and cost of maintenance, just all those other things. And then they kind of spits out the number. And from there, hopefully you can make a more informed decision based on what you can afford and not necessarily think, oh, well, it's okay because I can spend a little bit more, knowing that this is going to be a great investment. Because like we said, it may not be a great investment.
Yeah. And if you're keen to invest in real estate and you want to know how to actually do that, because we just told you that your primary home isn't going to do that for you, well, consider becoming a real estate investor. And we've got a couple of shows that help you think about that. You know, go back to our library of episodes and you can learn a little bit more about becoming a real estate investor. And if you want to become a real estate investor on like the triple easy method, right?
Like completely passively, right?
Yeah, completely passively. Because as a real estate investor, people call that passive income. And I understand why they say that, but I also kind of hate it because it takes a lot of work to be a real estate investor. But if you want to do it completely passively, consider investing in a REIT, a real estate investment trust. And there are a lot of these out there, right? But Vanguard in particular, we like them. They've got a great one. So the symbol for Vanguard's is VGSLX. And it has a 0.12 expense ratio, right? And so that REIT invests in office buildings, hotels, and other properties. So you're kind of getting in on real estate at this incredibly low expense, a well-diversified portfolio of real estate, you know, all across the country and all sorts of different types of buildings with this incredibly low expense ratio. That's a great way to passively and easily invest in real estate. And you know what? You can buy it today and trade it back tomorrow. So yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah. So if you really do want to become a real estate investor, those are two ways to do it. And there are a lot of websites actually out right now that that want you to invest in private real estate transactions. And the costs on those are really high too. And so I would say consider avoiding those that have oftentimes 2-5% cost to invest in private real estate transactions, and instead look at a REIT, because through a company like Vanguard, they're so low cost and they're so well diversified that you're getting a very similar product at essentially a fraction of the cost.
Are you invested in any REITs?
Yeah, so I am not invested in any REITs.
Yeah, I'm not either.
That's because, and I don't think either of us need to be invested.
Just because
in
we're already kind of doing real estate on our own terms?
Yeah, we're pretty heavily into real estate already. And so, yeah, to be invested in that, all my actual investments that aside from real estate, I want completely in the stock market because I already have heavy exposure to real estate.
Let's go ahead and get back to this beer.
Yeah, man. So we had the brewery Taru Ruse, sour blonde ale aged in oak barrels. Dude, this was delicious. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, by far the best $3-something beer I've had. I want to say maybe in my entire life. Like, right?
I think so.
Like, have you ever had a better deal on a beer? Because sometimes like the discount beers, like there's maybe some slight off flavors, or they're not quite as fresh if they're like an IPA, something like that. But this just blew my socks off. It's like, it's so good.
Yeah, sometimes you can find good beers on the discount shelf, but this is like a rare gem from the discount shelf. So a really good one. I'm glad we got to have this one together.
Yeah.
And spend almost nothing.
Okay, man, let's do a quick recap. Your house is an awful investment. It possibly could be a great purchase for you and your lifestyle, where you are in life. However, it's just not a great investment. There's a lot of other ways you can invest your money where it would work out better for you.
Yeah, where you get better returns, right? Because homes traditionally offer poor returns. If you look historically, real estate increases at a 4% clip and the stock market returns over the same period are over 10%. That's a huge disparity.
Another way your house stinks at being an actual investment is that it is unproductive in generating money. You have a lot of equity, a lot of cash just sitting there in this huge expense, and it doesn't do anything for you. Another reason why your house stinks as an investment is that it is too expensive. It's an expensive investment. You have to go all in just to kind of get your foot in the door to even get started. And it costs a lot of money to maintain. You're looking at 1% of the purchase price. And also to buy and sell a home, there are a ton of expenses associated with that that make it cost prohibitive to be an actual great investment.
Yeah, those transaction costs are nasty. And the lack of diversification is another reason that a home is a terrible investment. Obviously, you're tied to a specific geographic location. I mean, you really can't get more undiversified than buying a specific house in a specific neighborhood in a specific town. And not to mention all the external factors that are completely out of your control when it comes to taxes, government decisions, or just terrible neighbors.
That's right, man. You can't beat the diversification of an S&P 500 index fund or even like the total stock market index fund, right? And another reason why your home is not a great investment is because it is unproductive in generating money. There is a lot of equity, a lot of capital just sitting there in the home, and that money is not earning you any money unless you house hack. And that's something we want to challenge you guys to do. It's a creative way. It's a way to sort of, you know, reframe the way you think about your primary home as something that is a fake investment just because you live there and you think it's going to appreciate, to an investment that is actually creating real returns and real value for you.
Yeah, and ways to do that are to rent out a room to a friend or someone you know, or to buy a multifamily home from the beginning. That is the best way to actually start building wealth in real estate, as opposed to buying something that is going to be a millstone around your neck, just bleeding you dry financially every month.
That's right, man. And now it's time to wrap it up. So thanks to everyone for listening. Our home on the web is howtomoney.com. We'll have some show notes up there for you.
Yeah, and if you like what you hear and you found this podcast helpful, let us know by giving us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate it, and we'd love to hear from you. And be sure to subscribe while you're there.
Until next time, man.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.
Houses be lazy.